From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. An NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll out today shows Joe Biden leads the presidential race by 11 points over President Trump. And just 31% of people surveyed say they can trust the information coming from the president about the pandemic.
Meanwhile, Trump and Biden have sparred over the past 24 hours over the issue of wearing masks to prevent the spread of COVID-19, funding for the post office to run mail-in voting during the pandemic, and false allegations that Biden's running mate, Kamala Harris, is not legally qualified to run for vice president. Margaret Tolove is politics and White House editor at Axios. Margaret, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
And Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for NBC News. Sahil, welcome to you.
Great to join you.
And let's start with President Trump yesterday, once again fanning the flames of birtherism. It's a tactic that he used against Barack Obama a couple of years ago. Now, yesterday, he wouldn't disavow a conservative legal scholar's false claim that Kamala Harris can't run for vice president because her parents didn't have full American citizenship when she was born in Oakland, California.
I have no idea if that's right. I would have assumed the Democrats would have checked that out before she gets chosen to run for vice president.
Well, Margaret, it is not right. Why is President Trump doing this again?
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, it's not right. She was born in California. She's an American. Obviously, she can fill the spot on the ticket. There's no legal question about it whatsoever that any expert thinks is legit. But the president, we've seen him, and this is part of a broader piece, kind of testing gender baiting and race baiting, and now, citizenship, I guess, throughout the week since Harris was named. And this goes to two things. And one is, to sort of confuse or disenfranchise voters. And the other is just to delegitimize both the Biden-Harris ticket and potentially the outcome of the election. There's no evidence that this message is sort of taking root. The two sides have pretty much chosen off. There's not that many like swing voters in the country right now, the polling suggests. And of those who exist, there's no evidence to suggest that their thinking will swing on the basis of whether or not there is a outside theory or fringe theory about, citizenship. But nevertheless, it is yet another message, and it's created yet another distraction that we're covering instead of coronavirus. So it's right. All of a piece.
And Sahil, for that reason, do you expect the Biden campaign to even spend that much time addressing it?
I don't. This is part of a pattern, as Margaret was talking about. The president rarely sees a conspiracy theory about his opponents that he doesn't amplify. And he did this not only with President Obama about a decade ago. He did this with Ted Cruz, who was his Republican primary opponent in the 2016 election. Cruz was born in Canada to an American mother, a Cuban father, a natural born citizen because he was an American at birth. There was no actual question about his ability to serve as president. But Donald Trump kind of amplified this theory the same way he is now. He always presents it as, I'm just asking questions, but he knows exactly the impact of what he's doing. I should say Lindsey Graham, a senator from South Carolina, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, an ally of President Trump, has said there's no question as to whether Kamala Harris can serve. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm just going to quote his tweet here. She was born in the United States in 1964 to parents who were legally present under the Constitution. It's a pre-born president. She's unequivocally an American citizen, unquote. This should not even be an issue.
Well, Sahil and Margaret, I want to ask you about something else. So yesterday, President Trump said maybe wearing masks to stop the spread of COVID-19 is good. That's another mixed message. And Joe Biden spoke about wearing masks yesterday, too. Let's listen.
Be a patriot. Protect your fellow citizens. Protect your fellow citizens. Step up. Do the right thing.
Biden did not say, if elected, that he'd mandate mask wearing by executive order, but he did call on governors to enact rules. Margaret, what does this say about Biden's strategy?
what we can tell now, and it was building before the Harris announcement, but certainly now that he has a running mate in place, as we see their ads moving forward and their messaging moving forward, that litigating President Trump's handling of the coronavirus is going to be like at least a central theme and probably the central theme of the next 2 months, of the end of the final stretch of the campaign. I mean, it is a big deal that Biden has called on governors now to issue a 3-month mandatory outdoor mask mandate, because he is really, you know, putting his bet on the idea that this is something that the American public wants. It's one thing to say you have to wear a mask. It's another thing to try to tell governors what to do. And it's a calculated risk by the Biden campaign that I think is looking at the polling numbers and how Americans feel about the virus and saying that they believe that there is the support for mandates like this that take more drastic action to try to contain what hasn't been contained so far.
Sahil, this actually goes up very much in contrast with Trump's approach.
It absolutely does. And that's what the Biden campaign and Joe Biden are trying to do. They're trying to draw a stark kind of distinguishing feature to the way the president has handled this pandemic, which the Biden campaign says, you know, has been a complete disaster, and the way Joe Biden would handle it. And the single biggest thing is Biden says he would follow the experts. He would follow the science. Experts have widely said that mask wearing helps, especially, you know, especially when you're around people in close quarters. And somehow in the United States, unlike most of the developed world, refusal to wear a mask has become a kind of cultural signaling among the people who tend, you know, who are more likely than not to support President Trump. And the president has been very equivocal about masks at certain points, and he has touted unproven, untested remedies for this virus at various points against the better advice of experts. So I think that's the message that Joe Biden is trying to convey, that the current president is not listening to the experts, not listening to the science, and if you elect Biden, he says he is going to listen to them.
Right. Who would have thought that in 2020, the issue of wearing masks would have been a big political campaign issue, or that the U.S. Post Office would be a big campaign issue? Here, Donald Trump now saying that he will not veto any congressional economic relief deal that includes money that the Democrats want for the post office and mail-in voting in November. Yesterday, however, on Fox News, he seemed pretty happy with the idea of no deal and therefore the idea that the election might be undermined. Let's listen.
If they don't get those two items, that means you can't have universal mail-in voting because they're not equipped to have it.
Margaret, how would you describe this? Is this voter suppression flat out, and does it damage the public's faith in the election?
Yeah, I've been covering politics a long time. Not that much stuff shocks me anymore. I have to admit, I was actually shocked to hear the words come out of his mouth yesterday. And it's turned a tremendous amount of focus and attention now in terms of investigations, in terms of Congress, in terms of, you can imagine, investigative reporters onto the U.S. Postal Service and what is happening now with Louis DeJoy, who was the president's appointee to run the Postal Service, a major Trump donor and somebody with a logistics background, not a Postal Service background, but also someone who is invested in companies, I mean, millions worth in companies that are actually competitors of the U.S. Postal Service. So perhaps he didn't set out to reduce Postal Service funding for election purposes. Perhaps it was just had more of a tie to personal philosophy and business purposes. But obviously, the Postal Service's ability to have not just funding, but equipment, sorting, you know, their supply chain is essential when they're going to have this crush of an increase in mail-in ballots as a result of people's reluctance to go vote in person this year. We're seeing massive numbers, like not quite 1 in 2, but pretty close, of people saying that's how they want to vote this year. And for the Postal Service to have less capacity, less funding, rather than more, is, you know, it's obvious why that's a cause for concern.
But Sahil, what is the truth? Should the American public be worried about the post office's ability to deliver these ballots?
Well, I think for starters, we're in uncharted waters here. We've never had this kind of prevalence of mail-in voting before. It's going to rise at least twofold from the previous election. And in many, many swing states like Pennsylvania and Michigan that aren't very practiced with mail-in voting, they're expecting a massive, massive surge. So the honest answer is we don't know. And there's a very good chance, many election experts have said, that states are under-equipped to handle this at the moment. And the single biggest thing for voters to know is, depending on your state, it's important for all voters to know the rules as to what it takes to have their mail-in ballot counted. Some states, mm-hmm. you have to have it postmarked by a certain date, postmarked potentially by election date or maybe some other date. In other states, it has to arrive by election day. And this is where it gets critical, because if you, for instance, send your ballot 3, 4, 5 days before the election, and suddenly there's this massive surge that the post office cannot handle, and your ballot does not get delivered in time, it may end up not counting. And that's one of the biggest concerns at this moment about these cutbacks that Louis DeJoy has implemented in the Postal Service that could slow down these ballots just in time for the election and potentially, potentially distort the outcome.
Yeah. I sense lawsuits. Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for NBC News, and Margaret Tolov, politics and White House editor at Axios. Thanks to you both.
School is back in session in many parts of the country, and educators are learning what's working and what's not in real time. At Mount St. Mary's Academy, it's a private Catholic school in the Sierra Nevada foothills, Principal Edie Wood has been experimenting with in-person learning by bringing in just a few kids at a time on campus. The school has been in session for about 2 weeks now, and Principal Wood joins us now via Skype from Grass Valley, California, about lessons learned so far. Principal Wood, welcome.
Thank you, Tanya, for having me here today.
Yes, so you all have spent the summer coming up with plans on how to bring students and staff back into the building. You've done your assessments, you've had students pick out lockers and all of those things. Why did you decide in-person learning was the way to go?
You know, students need to be on campus. They need to see their teachers. They need to have that in-person instruction. They need that socialization with their friends. And for families, you know, it's a struggle. You know, they're trying to work and support their families. And many families really struggle with doing the distance learning. So we felt like this was something that was really important for our families and our community.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has offered guidance for schools reopening this fall. They're suggesting things like masks and testing. Tell us a little bit more about what you all are doing to prepare students and keep them safe.
Yes. So in April, we had our first version of our protocols in place, and that was in consultation with the CDC and our local county public health officials. And so we put together those plans that really focus on, you know, hygiene, social distancing, and doing temperature checks when students and families enter the building, you know, disinfecting as we go throughout the day. So there's a very intentional effort in our protocols to keep the teachers and the students and families healthy and safe.
And in true form, we can hear the school sounds behind you. I can hear your phone ringing. That's a principal's phone ringing for sure. You have about 160 students in your school, so it's not a huge amount of kids. But can you talk a little bit more about the lessons you've actually learned in the last 2 weeks that you're taking into the school year? What's working and what's not? Because we can all lay out plans, but the best made plans, you know, they can often change once you put them in practice.
Right. Definitely as a staff, at least once a week, but we meet a lot more than that. So we'll have a meeting and we'll come up with some really great plans and ideas and then maybe make some changes. So because we've had students on campus for the last 2 weeks, the time that it takes to take temperature checks and then document those temperatures, that's taking us a little bit of time just using and getting an accurate read on the digital thermometers. It's been good to put those things in place so that, you know, when we welcome everyone back on campus on the same day, we've worked through some of those logistics.
You know, we've been hearing this week, though, that schools across the country that have offered in-person learning have reported an uptick in COVID-19 cases. I think somewhere upwards of 2,000 folks now quarantined, children and adults. Are you concerned at all about the spread of COVID from classrooms?
I think the whole country is worried about that. But we do feel like because we're a small school, we have really nice, great big windows. We have nice big outdoor spaces for students. And we've really put a lot of thought into the direction students are coming in and out of classrooms, sanitizing. We've been able to distance our desks and make plans for spreading out our recess time, our lunch time. We've actually built in an extra play time in the afternoon for the younger grade students. So we really have spent a lot of time at looking at the school day and trying to figure out what's the best way to keep everyone safe. And our families feel very confident in what we're doing, that we're trying to do our best to be safe.
Are you prepared to pivot if that changes?
We do have distance learning plan, a handbook that's already in the works. We're just sort of in our final edits of that. And we have been surveying the families also to look at, you know, their connectivity. Grass Valley's, well, like most, a lot of places in our country, internet isn't always stable. So we've already, you know, looked at those plans and already created a handbook for distance learning.
What advice would you have for other educators who are working through their plans or parents as they're considering whether or not to send their children back to school for in-person learning?
I just think that in all of our communities, it's really important that we look at how we can best support families. I hope that we can all work together as a community to make that happen.
That's Principal Edie Wood talking with us about her school's reopening plan for in-person learning. Principal Wood, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
And let's go now to the Navajo Nation, where tribal schools are getting mixed messages about how classes should resume next month. The Bureau of Indian Education, a part of the Department of the Interior that runs 53 tribal schools, recently released guidance strongly urging teachers to return to the classroom. But Shauna Allison Bacenti, head of school at the Navajo Preparatory School in Farmington, New Mexico, is making the choice to keep her school virtual for now. Shauna, welcome.
Hello.
It sounds like you are getting a lot of conflicting messages here. The Bureau wants school to reopen to the fullest extent possible. President Jonathan Nez of the Navajo Nation says they should remain virtual all semester. And then you have the state government, New Mexico, with its own recommendations. Ultimately, this decision comes down to you. What are you thinking about right now?
We do. We are a tribally controlled grant Bureau of Indian Education school, so we do have the autonomy to determine how we plan to operate. And we're going to do what's in best interest of the safety of our school. And we'll look at community spread. We also have to respect what our nation has gone through. And it's real. It's embedded in what's true. And then what's true is I have even had an employee who lost a brother, a mother, and a father all within, you know, a month's time of each other. And and so we're going to go ahead and stay virtual, and we're going to move into our phase two when it's safe.
All right. And, you know, some people are saying that the federal government, the advice they're giving schools, tribal schools, is not great, considering the numbers that you just mentioned and the caseloads that you've mentioned. Do you think the guidance from the Interior Department is good?
You know, that's probably the hot question right now. And, you know, and I know they survey tribal leaders, and we're also dealing, you know, with tribal nations across the United States. And so everyone's experience is different. And our reality is, can you truly provide a quality education to these rural, remote areas through remote learning?
Yeah, exactly. Some students don't have internet.
Right. The infrastructure is definitely a need that it's been, you know, with this pandemic, it has shown our weakness and our vulnerability within tribal communities and, you know, where we need to invest and where we need the support. And so that we can truly have an equal playing field when it comes to education among indigenous populations.
And tell me more about that, because your high school has resident halls for students, primarily because you live in such a remote area. How are you handling that?
Sure. So we have our students come from 50 different communities. Some have to drive 7 hours away to get to Navajo Preparatory School. Some live in very rural areas. And, you know, we have surveyed and tested and, you know, looked at the cellular maps that are available. And basically we're finding hotspots that can allow so many gigs, you know, for a student to just operate their computer. We've gone to ensuring that no student's going to have to print and that there won't be these download speeds, that everything is within their reach. But it's as good as it connects.
Well, and meanwhile, you have the problem of the virus in your community. Sunny Dooley, who is a Navajo storyteller, recently told Scientific American that she sees COVID-19 as a monster feasting on the Diné people. That's the traditional name that some Navajo people use for themselves. And she says it's because the Diné are the perfect human for it to invade. How do you interpret that? Because you're dealing with not only problems at school, but health problems in the community.
Right. It is. It's, you know, I think our Navajo language teacher, you know, we had our back to school talked about this monster, and it's already been in our stories of disease and virus is always been a monster in our traditional stories. Because she goes on to really explain the trials and tribulations of our Navajo people. And through it all, we still exist. And through it all, we're still here. And through it all, we will continue to fight this monster. You know, but it also is telling us as Indigenous people that a healthy lifestyle and a healthy mindset and a healthy well-being is so important, because it will feast on our what is vulnerable in us in a population. So we need to acknowledge that we have infrastructure issues, that we need to put money towards that and empower our students. That's the whole purpose. And that's why Navajo Prep has existed through, you know, its transition from a Methodist mission to now an own Indian sovereign, a sovereign institution of learning for high school. You know, as the words of Chief Manuelito, use education as a weapon. And that's still what we do.
Shauna Allison Bocenti, head of school at the Navajo Preparatory School in Farmington, New Mexico. Thank you very much for your time. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Bloomberg News reports that SoftBank is investing an additional $1.1 billion into WeWork, which operates a number of co-working spaces across the country. But WeWork has had a tough time during this pandemic. More people are working from home and memberships have declined. So what does the pandemic mean for co-working? Let's bring in Mike Regan. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. Welcome back, Mike.
Oh, thanks, Tanya.
So SoftBank has already poured in a lot of money into WeWork. What do you make of this additional investment? What's the larger context?
Well, right. As you say, SoftBank had already invested more than $10 billion in WeWork, as my colleague Jillian Tan, who wrote the story you're talking about, has reported. And then the wheels kind of fell off the bus for WeWork. The goal had been to sell stock in the company to the public through an IPO last year. But as that deal got closer and closer to hitting Wall Street, the scrutiny on WeWork became very intense, and on the founder, Adam Neumann, and his relationships with the company. And that sort of forced them to cancel the IPO. And SoftBank has had to really write down the value of its investments. So this latest debt financing that it's giving WeWork actually relates back to another deal they had with WeWork, where that was sort of a two-part deal where they were going to buy about $3 billion worth of the company's stock, its equity, and also loan it more than $1 billion. But SoftBank backtracked on that, and a bit of a legal squabble ensued. So what has resulted is they are actually going to go through with this debt financing for WeWork, but not the equity investment they made. So they're still involved and clearly still want to try to recoup their losses in this company, but they're not as aggressive as they once were in financing it.
Okay, so this is about debt financing, but WeWork has seen its membership fall because of this pandemic. But I'm wondering if that's shifting. One of our colleagues now works from a co-working spot, and she said she's really grateful for it because she's not in her house. And there are other people who are feeling this way too, maybe some working parents who are trying to get out of the house. I mean, as companies continue remote work this fall, could we see co-working spaces get a boost?
Well, I think it's possible. WeWork itself has said they've actually seen some renewed interest from companies, big companies that are trying to be more flexible with their workspaces too. And as you said, anecdotally, maybe people working at home might want to take some office space somewhere. But it, again, if you look at the numbers, it's not yet enough to compensate for the lost business they've had because of the economic downturn. Their memberships are down 12% in the quarter. I do think what they could take advantage of is the fact that office real estate is not exactly a hot market right now. So they might be able to renegotiate some of their leases or renew some of their leases at better terms for them.
Yeah, we also saw this week REI, the outdoor retailer, trying to sell its custom-built headquarters in Bellevue, Washington. So this kind of speaks to what you're talking about. In the 30 seconds I have, what do you see for the future of these types of spaces?
Well, I think big companies are greatly rethinking how they think about real estate and probably are going to scale back on their office footprint. So there could be potentially an opportunity for the co-working spaces to take advantage of that.
Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Early on a Wednesday morning, nurses roll 83-year-old Reverend Ralph Key into one of the most energy-intensive spaces on the planet, a hospital operating room.
I'm coming with a patient. Get out of my way, please.
The healthcare sector produces 10% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. Hospitals contribute to more than a third of that, and operating rooms are their hotspots for emissions, waste, and energy use.
Here we are.
But this OR at Boston Medical Center is about as climate-friendly as they come. A renovation has helped reduce the electricity the hospital draws from the grid by 70% since 2012. As he prepares for surgery, Key says he's pleased.
That's important. That's right. Talk about climate change and all that. We're right in the middle of it.
So Ralph Key has agreed to let us watch all of the things nurses and doctors will do differently to reduce the environmental footprint from his surgery. Martha Biebinger from member station WBUR picks up the story.
Nurses bring Ralph Key to a stop in the middle of a room filled with monitors and movable lights. Rolling tables are covered in blue cloth. Ralph is here because his left carotid artery, one of two major blood vessels that sends blood to his brain, is blocked. Ralph's procedure begins with general anesthesia, delivered via a plastic mask that covers his nose and mouth.
All right, Ralph. Nice big deep breaths in and out. We're going to take great care of you, okay?
And right here, with each breath, Ralph's climate change journey begins. Ralph inhales sevoflurane. In many operating rooms across the country, the gas going into Ralph's lungs would be desflurane. But Dr. Mauricio Gonzalez says BMC rarely uses it anymore.
So desflurane has a higher carbon footprint. It's a bigger greenhouse gas than the other anesthetics.
By one calculation, desflurane is so carbon intensive that giving it to Ralph for this two-hour surgery would be like driving roughly 756 miles as compared to 16 miles with the equivalent dose of sevoflurane. The CO2 Ralph exhales this morning will be captured inside a canister with pellets that Gonzalez says are safe to throw away.
The whole focus on the environmental impact of operating rooms and anesthesia, it's a relatively new thing. So yes, we're responsible for the patient at the table, but in the end, we're all responsible for that planet we live in.
That attention to the planet unfolds during Ralph's surgery in two more ways: lower energy use and less waste. And if you've been inside a hospital lately, you know there's a lot of waste.
This is paper. Anything that rips goes in there.
Nurse Polly Woodworth tears the back from a package of sterile tubing and tosses the ripped pieces in a large green plastic bag.
So we have all these receptacles. Green is recycle. Red is for bloody trash. This is laundry, and this is clean trash.
Sometimes deciding what goes where is just too much in an already high-stress environment. Woodworth watches one of the surgeons toss a large piece of molded plastic in the trash. She moves it to recycling.
I'm a trash picker. I can't help myself.
Boston Medical Center recycles about 32% of what would otherwise be trash. Still, today, the trash bag fills almost twice as fast as its green bag neighbor. To understand why, let's get back to the operating table, where Ralph is now unconscious. Surgeon Doug Jones looks for ways to prop up Ralph's shoulder and create better access to his neck.
Just, you're going to reach and you're going to grab that shoulder with your... Yeah, that's fine.
Guys, ready?
Yep.
One, two, three.
So we need a towel.
Can we get a blanket, please?
Every towel, blanket, drape, and dozens of packages of tubing and sponges arrive in a double layer of a synthetic fabric called Blue Wrap. It cannot be recycled. This hospital alone tosses 13 tons of it a year. There's a partial solution in the works, turning those sheets of Blue Wrap into tote bags.
Right angle.
Dr. Jones uses what looks like a thin pair of scissors, but with hooks instead of sharp tips. Jones needs to clean tissue away from Ralph's clogged carotid artery and get a better look.
It's a little bit deep, so I'm just trying to get... But it's right here.
Jones punctures the blood vessel, clamps one end, and threads a wire through the plaque buildup, singing along to his R&B playlist.
Yeah.
That's where the...
Keep going. A little bit more. Stop. You good?
One reason operating rooms are such energy epicenters is ventilation. The air in this room is sucked out and replaced for purity 20 times an hour, as compared to 6 times an hour in the hospital room where Ralph will spend the night. And operating rooms are increasingly equipped with high-tech machinery that increase their energy load.
All right, we're going to start x-raying.
Surgeons roll a machine over Ralph. It takes images of his shoulder and neck as Jones opens Ralph's artery to slide in a stent.
Can you dim the room lights?
We can do it here.
40 LED bulbs in the room fade, making the images of Ralph's left carotid artery glow on two large monitors. The hospital has converted all of its lighting to LED bulbs, which are between 50 and 80% more efficient. And it's installed sensors that turn off lights in any unoccupied room or hallway.
Is the artery stable?
Stabilizing it.
I need a new stitch.
Operating rooms are colder than the rest of the hospital. Keeping the room temperature around Ralph at 65 degrees is no easy feat with a dozen bodies, lots of lights, and machinery. Boston Medical Center uses what's called a free cooling system. In the winter, it uses outside air to chill water that cools this OR. The hospital is warmed by the heat thrown off of an energy plant installed 3 years ago.
Sheath looks good, right?
All
right? I think we're ready to clamp.
In a few minutes, Jones steps away from the table, leaving the final stitching to other members of his team. X-ray images of Ralph's neck before and after the surgery are still on a screen. 2 hours ago, his left carotid artery was almost completely blocked.
I mean, you can see there's just a whisper of blood getting through there, and now you can see it's normal.
Boston Medical Center aims to make similar repairs to an ailing planet. Senior VP for Facilities Bob Biggio is one of the masterminds behind the hospital's climate-focused renovations.
You know, when we launched our campus redesign plan, it seemed only natural that trying to create a healthy environment for our patients was one of the places you would start with trying to keep your patients healthy.
The hospital aims to be carbon neutral next year, although meeting that target is proving to be more difficult than imagined. BMC offsets carbon produced here with renewable energy credits from solar power purchased in North Carolina. But as the grid gets greener overall, the value of those credits is dropping. And now, filtering indoor air has become more energy intensive during the coronavirus pandemic.
Orange Jello. I like oranges.
By mid-afternoon, Ralph Key is sitting up in bed, eating Jello and applesauce.
I was pleased and almost surprised that I could start eating already. So I must be doing pretty good. Yeah, and praise God for that, right? And the people that did it.
Ralph will get a full meal soon. Anything he does not eat will be dumped into the hospital's biodigester, which turns 4 tons of food waste into water every month. The hospital has spent more than $400 million on all of these changes. They haven't paid for themselves yet, but Biggio projects they will within 3 years. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger.
In the Air Tonight, the classic from Phil Collins, became a hit way back in 1981. 39 years later, it's at number 2 this week on iTunes sales, thanks to a viral video that 22-year-old twins Tim and Fred Williams made of themselves listening to the song for the first time. I can feel it coming in
the air tonight. Oh, Lord. Well, I could see somebody, this is like a WWE entrance, but I could see somebody walking down to the ring to this, bro. Like, come on.
That's understandable. Man.
Of course, the best part, which is the best part for all of us, we watch the twins hear for the first time that classic drum solo kick in.
They felt like y'all were sleeping on me. Let's wake them up.
I watched the video like 10 times, and thanks to the twins, more people are buying and streaming some of Phil Collins' other hits too. It's a Phil Collins revival, against all odds.
This week, Phoenix officially recorded its hottest summer on record, the average high nearly 108 degrees. The city has also been a COVID-19 hotspot, and with Congress deadlocked on pandemic relief, many people here will struggle to pay their rent next month, and probably their utility bills too. Like many cities across the country, the city of Phoenix announced in March that it wouldn't cut off water through the summer. But now some tough decisions have to be made. Catherine Sorensen is the director of the city's water department, and she joins us now. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Peter. It's nice to be here.
And what's the latest thinking? Do you think you're going to be extending this moratorium on water shutoffs in Phoenix?
I do. We've been experiencing an incredibly hot summer. I mean, summers here are always hot, but even for us, this one's been pretty bad. And as you mentioned, you know, pandemic conditions here are still a struggle. And so I do see us potentially extending probably at least for a few more months, maybe even longer than that. We kind of are playing it day by day and seeing how things go.
A lot of people are obviously hurting economically. How many more households than usual aren't paying their bills? Have you crunched those numbers yet?
I'm happy to report that for the most part, our customers are continuing to pay their bills. I think they understand that if they can't keep up with their bills now, that a much larger one is coming down the road. For example, when the stimulus checks came out, we saw a big surge in payment of past delinquencies. But of course, yeah, we do see a higher number of delinquencies now because people out there are hurting.
You have your budget to think about, though, right? I mean, city and state budgets have been destroyed by this pandemic. How long can you keep a moratorium going and still remain healthy?
That's a really good question. And we're looking at those numbers almost on a daily basis. The other issue to think about is that, you know, much of our infrastructure is bonded, and that means we have creditors. And part of our bond covenants, or our promise to our creditors, is that we will, in fact, faithfully and responsibly collect revenues from our customers. One of the things that has actually helped our finances, ironically, is that it is so hot here this summer in Phoenix, so abnormally hot. What that means is that our water demands are higher and our revenues are higher as a result.
Well, these are questions that people are having, utility directors are having across the country. And Democrats in Congress have tried to come up with this federal moratorium on utility shutoffs. It has stalled so far. But do you think that decisions like that should be left up to local governments like yourself, or should Congress intervene?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I appreciate that a moratorium across the nation is very well intended. And certainly we're all concerned about, you know, people's health and people's financial health during this pandemic. And I do think that those decisions are much better left to local city councils. They have the best information to make those decisions.
Even before the pandemic hit, I know your department was looking into new technology that would restrict water flow for households that weren't paying their bills, not cutting it off. How would that work?
So we took this on about a year ago, and really our main concern at that time was how hot it is here in the summer. And we wanted to come up with an alternative to disconnecting people from their water and sewer service during our hot summer months. And so we started experimenting with a device that basically restricts flow. It continues to provide an amount of water that is adequate for public health, for basic indoor needs, but is not the full service that is provided normally.
So you could, for example, wash the dishes or take a shower, but not water the lawn?
Right. That's the basic idea, is that it's an amount of water that's adequate for indoors. So normally it takes, for example, a second to fill a cup of water. It would take more like 15 or 20 seconds to fill a cup of water, for example. But yeah, you couldn't use it for outdoor landscaping. It really would just be enough for indoor uses.
An employee of your department told the Phoenix New Times anonymously that low flow barely gives people enough water to shower and said there's no civil, moral, ethical reason for this practice to be implemented at this time. And this was a few months ago. What's your response to that?
You know, we also have a civil and moral obligation to ensure that we have a utility that serves our community. And unfortunately, it's an extremely expensive undertaking. When we fail to provide safe, clean water across the community, when we fail to collect enough revenue to do that, when we fail to invest in aging infrastructure, it's really the most vulnerable in our community who ultimately pay the price. And that's what we saw in Flint, Michigan as well. So every utility director across the country is trying to balance those individual needs with the community needs as best they can.
And do you think you'll use this technology, because you were just studying it before, do you think you'll use this technology when the pandemic conditions get to a point where you can continue adjusting people's water, disconnecting people's water?
So that was the recommendation of our Citizens Water Advisory Committee. And the idea behind it is it's certainly a better alternative than shutting people off entirely. And that's the norm across the industry today.
That's Catherine Sorensen, Director of the City of Phoenix Water Department. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Hey, appreciate it. Nice talking with you, Peter. Welcome to Phoenix.
Thank you. And Tanya, as you know, I'm now based in Phoenix, joining you.
Welcome to the West Coast.
From Boston. Yes. Oh my God, I got to wake up early. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.